Welcome to the Ecology and Research Channel. Green issues, ecology, incredibly important to embodiment. Obviously, we're embodied in place, we're embodied in a world. How we treat ourselves is how we treat the planet and vice versa. So this is super important, I think, for our whole planet. Research relates to this. We've sort of put two together there. We didn't quite know where to put research, so we put them in with ecology. This stage has lots of great speakers, people I personally enjoy, and it's sponsored by Forests Without Frontiers. So rather than sell a sponsorship for this channel, we decided, you know what, let's give it away to a green charity. Tree planting seemed a good one. We thought we can all get behind that. We all breathe air. We looked into a load, actually. Some of them are quite famous, but don't actually plant a lot of trees, weirdly, or other things aren't so good with them. This one, Forests Without Frontiers, really does the work. They're in charge of a really big reforestation project in Central Europe, but, you know, we're all breathing it, thank you. It's run by Nicoletta, a very cool lady, and just a cool organization that really does the work. The money goes, you know, efficiently to actually planting trees. I'm happy to be supporting them. For me, it was like, you know, when we were looking at our charities to support, a green one just made a lot of sense to me. That just was obvious. Please do support them. Links below. As well as that, enjoy the whole channel. There's so much richness in this topic.
So what I'm saying, what I will talk about in the next 10 minutes is a buffet. They are really appetizers, and I will just very quickly allude to them. I put my email there, so if people want to continue the conversation, I am so very happy to do that. This is an overview, okay? This screen is an overview of some of the directions in which my work has done. I grew up in Israel, came to California, the US at 28, and the first thing that struck me was how differently embodied Californian culture, and I learned that the US has many different ways to be of embodiment. And so I took courses in anthropology, and that sensitizes me to what I think of as choreography of culture. Have done some work in American schools and choreography of classrooms, and then have edited What Embodiment Means, a volume that talked about embodiment and other issues in visual art, music, dance, and drama education. Being a musician, the notion of dissonance, which is extremely embodied, I found it an important invitation to explore deeper issues. And the one topic that I would like to say a little more today is the notion of research methods and how embodied they are. I will focus on interviews, observations we attend with our body and to our and other people's body. We listen, of course, beyond content for tone and expression. And I have a couple of publications if people are interested that I send to Beatrice. The biggest thing for me, I always thought that researchers were big head and no body at all. It was really dichotomized. We all know the Descartes, you know, the supposedly dichotomy of mind and body. And so the book that I edited in 2004 kind of struck me as knowing bodies moving mind. When we do field work, there is tremendous knowledge that the bodies bring. Perception, positionality, how and where, and tuning to what is happening. And that creates a moving mind. It shapes our interpretation and understanding. And then I mentioned earlier the notion of dissonance that is always embodied, that can be an invitation, a powerful invitation to deepen exploration and to see with more complexity. A reminder for those of us who are in the social sciences in qualitative research that the two main goals are understanding, empathic understanding of lived experience and expansion of meaning. And John Dewey's point about art, but equally true for everyday life and for research, recognition is perception arrested, has stayed with me. So when you look at a picture, take a minute to look at a picture. Many of us have been inspired by Martin Buber. And you see the picture, you can recognize Martin Buber. You can recognize Jen Urquhart, whose work you will hear in a few minutes. She is to the right. And then when we go beyond recognition, what can we say about the lived experience of Buber's expression, the way that he smiles and listens? What can we say about the embodiment and the experience of Jen when she's in her studio, carefree and maybe before or after a performance? So even in these very quick notes, we get a sense of how important embodiment is. The stereotypes that I've been working on, of course, were the distant experimental researchers, but even in that particular domain, we are always clearly embodied, as you see in that stereotypical researcher working with Norwegian grants. Even when it's distant and behind glass, it is still, of course, embodied. It still shapes relationship. And this image is maybe from the one work that revolutionized the social sciences. Some of you may recognize anthropologist Bronislav Malinowski, who came to Papua New Guinea, meant to be there for a few weeks, and has stayed there for 4 years because of the First World War. And you see in the way that he sits, of course, he's still an outsider, but it's a different kind of outsider in this image than in the image before. Including the making of music together, speaking a musical language and other languages together. So the assumptions, the foundation is that we are always positioned in relations to what we study, physically, gender-wise, culturally, values, and we are always embedded in values of the social sciences. If we are unaware of them, that could be, as many people have wrote, can lead to distortion that, that is a problem in any kind of finding and research. And our bodies can provide important clues to our own values in resonance, in dissonance with what we study, because we always have relationship to what we study. So this is a picture of my early me. I think I was 4 here. And I wanted to highlight something that is true for musicianship and true for research. There are what I think two types of relationship, two pronged. One of them is you see me in relation to the piano, and maybe you can imagine this would be folk songs, to the music. So it's me and the music, me and the piano. And then in about 10, 15 minutes, there would have been more people entering into our home and everybody would be singing folk songs. This is the late 50s in Israel, and I would be playing. And so when I was kind of warming my hands, I was aware that this would be played to bigger audiences. And of course it's true in research. Those who know me, I'm pretty narrow-minded and very quick at looking at things. But when I do a case study, knowing it's going to be communicated, then I am so expanded, I see more and I hear more. And so the relationship to audience is extremely important. A couple of minutes on research methods. So open-ended observations are central. You see a picture of a group of my doctoral students and attending both to what happens outside and to the writing. Interviews are very central in qualitative research, and we could do a picture of how we are tuned, how we create a listening zone. But I also chose to use Steinar Kvale's metaphor of the flying, the traveling interviewer. And so we go and collect perceptions and communications, and that really is the notion of constructed reality. And then in data analysis, when we actually look at the mind that we have done in field work, looking for the nuggets, looking for the findings and what we can communicate to the world, it's a very different kind of body language, much more contained. This is the last one, and this is a snippet from my assignments to both doctoral students and other people that I teach in different parts of the world. And in that assignment, I asked people and myself to choose two spaces, one that creates resonance, one that we like and one that we don't like. Stay with it for a long time, change bodily positions and postures, and see what each of them allows us to see. Of course, take field notes to be able to record it and to communicate it. This is very much an appetizer. I would love if we have time for questions and more persuasions. And I'm very much looking forward to hear other panel members on a similar topic. Thank you. And I should stop sharing my screen. Yeah.
It's my turn now. All right, I'll take over. Thank you so much, Leora, for Your wonderful presentation, and also for putting this panel together. It's really an honor to be part of it. I'm going to share my screen. My name is Merel Visser. I listen to Merel. In Dutch, it would be Merel. My home country is the Netherlands. I currently live in the United States. I am the director of the Medical and Health Humanities Program at Drew University. I also am affiliated with the Dutch University of Humanistic Studies, where I am an associate professor in care ethics. Can you see my screen? Yes? Okay, great. So what you are looking at is an image of the pine trees screen. And this is a pair of six panels next to each other by the Japanese artist Hasegawa Tohaku. I hope I pronounced that correct. It's made a long time ago in the late 16th century. And you can view it in the Tokyo National Museum. I think it's in the archives now, but you probably have seen it somewhere because it's a rather famous view. It depicts a view of Japanese pine trees in the mist. And parts of the trees, as you can see, are more visible and other parts are a little bit obscured. And to me, they illustrate the Zen Buddhist concept of ma, M-A, ma, which stands for an aesthetic of simplicity on the countryside. I just moved to the countryside myself in New Jersey, so not in Japan. And this is what I saw yesterday during a walk. It's a little bit of a different image, this image made me pause as well, what I saw. It stands for a field, and I've been interested in field thinking for quite a while. And that is why ma, so the Japanese concept, appeals to me so much, because ma can be translated as gap, or space, or pause. It's also about the awareness of form and of non-form that derives from an intensification of our vision of what we see. So it makes us pause. And last weekend, I don't know, maybe you've read the New York Times. There was an interesting piece in the New York Times about a completely different topic, but the title was, "There's Virtue in Vagueness." And I love that. I love that vagueness and that ambiguity. And I actually think that as qualitative inquirers, as embodied qualitative inquiries, we can be much more sensitive and open to vagueness and to ambiguity. Because when our understanding of the phenomenon that we are interested in is not crystallized yet, there is a promise that can be fulfilled. And that's what I'm always searching for in my work as an inquirer. So why do I bother about those things, about vagueness, about openness, receptivity, those kinds of stone markers in this short intro? That comes from Jacques Rancière. He actually, I think to me, he really addresses a problem in our society that I'm searching for solutions of. He captures a political argument for what he calls a political aesthetics. In his work, he addresses the overly attention for the verbal in our society. And I'm very aware that I'm also now verbally expressing myself. The purpose of my short talk today is that I would like to show how we can include nonverbal approaches to ways of knowing, like sensorial ways of knowing and the body, but also ways of knowing that move beyond our body, perhaps. This is Jacques Rancière. And my research focuses, I carry out both philosophical and empirical research. I always combine both, and it focuses on care, on the ethics of care and how we can live a good life together in the context of society. And also in terms of being responsive to the plurality of voices and groups. And the moment that people start to live and work together, the moment their bodies find themselves in shared spaces, the moment we share something, like being in this virtual space even, or when we share a property, when we share the same neighborhood, stores, anything, they begin to form a community. And a community to me is more than just the natural relationships that people have with one another. It's also about setting rules and regulations, of course, and about how we assign and accept responsibilities for our community. But what I find fascinating is that in the shared, in that same community, so that which connects us to each other, is not so much about the shared land or the shared values, but it's the shared becomes possible because we have a shared sensibility. We share the same perceptions. And in that shared sensibility also lies the fundament of a group to include or exclude members, who belongs and who does not belong. And there, you know, well, I think we all know that something can go wrong there. So how do we develop our perceptions, our sensibilities, and how can we become more inclusive? And this is a second slide to show you why I'm doing this research, because I also want to counter the dominance of linear and mathematical thinking in our society. I also know that there are strands of mathematics that are much more open to the body and to intuition. I think it's even called an intuitive mathematics. But what I'm especially interested in is how artists have played with different ways to look at perspective. So in the upper image, you can see more dominant ways to look at, or yes, to grasp an object, even to capture an object, just as we do as qualitative researchers. It's a linear causal way of looking at the world. But in the image below, this is a painting of an icon. The perspective lies outside of the painting. And that is a very different way of looking at what reality is. So I'm curious about how we can open up our perceptions. How can we go beyond the senses and move to that perspective that is outside of the painting? And that is when an apophatic view, it's what I've dubbed apophatic, comes into play. It's a negating approach to knowing. It's almost an unknowing of what we are used to. And this is, I find this a beautiful image by Sherry Leighton that represents that view, because there's another side, I think, to our experience. An important element of our experience is usually left out in our research. So how can we also be inclusive to humanity and to the bodies, even by going and moving beyond our bodies? It sounds like a paradox, but I think detour can actually be access here. So in doing this, I think may bring life to the inner life of the researcher, to what's inside of our bodies. We are no longer in, Leora already mentioned it, in the Cartesian body, in the mind-body split with the world, featured by discourse of the outer world almost echoing in our inner world. But instead, we become a multidimensional, relational, and apophatic body. We have a different type of engagement with the world. And we become resonating bodies, actually, with the world and with the questions that are central to our research. So what do we do then? What does this mean practically? Well, it means to become a bit like this lion on the ball. What we can do is to meander around the topic of our inquiry. So instead of wanting to grasp it, we can practice to be in an intricate balance with the topic of our research. Perhaps you know that if the lion here would look at the ball directly, it would lose its balance, it would fall. So there is a very intricate interplay between the lion, his paws, the ball. And I think even the audience, if there is an audience, let's assume that there is an audience looking at this lion playing with the walls, with the ball. So the outer world will no longer then be conceptualized in our inner world, but it becomes something that lives and unfolds in the space between our outer and inner world. Again, this is, here I refer to the Buddhist concept of ma that I started with. So this space in between our thinking, our sensing, and our feeling becomes important. Not so much, I do not mean that thinking and sensing and feeling is not important, but there's also something that's going on in between all these different senses. And this refers to developing a, well, not so much our linear type of thinking, but a contemplative, heartfelt, living thinking. And the Danish philosopher Lockstrup, perhaps some of you have heard of him, would say thinking questioningly, thinking tentatively, meandering around. And that, I think, can also bring a certain type of aliveness to our research. And there are many, many instances where I see my students doing data analysis. They code and they create themes and categories from these codes. But sometimes the categories seem to match perfectly, but it just doesn't feel alive. So what's going on in this practice of coding and of generating findings that makes rich data lose its life? And that is what I've been thinking about. And I think that if we can support ourselves and our students with becoming almost, silently receptive to insights that are hidden, perhaps, within these categories, between these categories, then we can reach completely different kinds of understandings, more lived understandings, hopefully, in our research. Do I have time for a very short story? No? No, I see Leora nodding. Okay, so then I'll wrap it up. I'm looking forward to hearing questions and to the panel discussion. Thank you so much for your attention.
Okay, so it's going to be my turn. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Hello, so I'm Koji Matsunobu from Japan, but I live in Hong Kong. Let me start my PowerPoint. Yes. So the title of my talk is Musical Way of Embodying Nature, Place, and Memory. And this talk is based on my ethnographic studies as well as my recent experience through music. As Leora mentioned earlier, music is a whole body experience involving our emotional spirit. And musicians like us often feel that the instrument is part of the body. But also we are becoming disembodied because music is becoming a sort of one-finger activities recently. So I like to share what I learned from the shakuhachi, which is Japanese bamboo flute. It's also getting very popular outside Japan. So we have a modern type of shakuhachi that allows you to play Western scale and to play with other instruments. But my focus here is a classical type, traditional type. So this type of flute is less processed. We make a flute in such a way that to preserve and appreciate nature inherent to each piece of bamboo. So the product is less processed. We don't apply layers of paste and lacquer inside the flute to make it smooth or control the inner bore shape. So the resulting sound is less standardized. The pitch and tone color of the flute is greatly influenced by the original shape of the piece of bamboo. When we may play indoors and outdoors, when you play outdoors, you feel that birds and animals, you know, coming to you. When playing a long flute, you know, you feel as if you are inhaling and exhaling the earth energy. So this practice leads to embodiment of nature and place. And I highlight some key aspects here. So diversity in this practice is brought by nature. Each piece of bamboo comes with various shapes and lengths, and that results in various sound and expression. Because each piece of bamboo is unique and the instrument is not standardized, so some notes may not come out as resonant as other notes, but we don't see it as a problem. We don't treat it as a defect, but we embrace it as the character of the flute. Making music is a series of negotiation with nature, negotiating between how the bamboo wants to sound and how we want it to sound. Right? So here we don't have a sense of self-expression. We have to learn how to accommodate ourselves to the characteristics of each flute rather than controlling all the variables of nature. We craft the instrument little by little, sometimes spending months and years. And during this period, our body becomes used to the way most appropriate to play that particular flute. It is a form of personalization. When the flute has a very distinctive, strong characteristic, our body goes through particularization. And because of that, we often find it difficult to play other flute when our body is particularized and accustomed to one type of flute. So this means the practice requires prolonged engagement. It starts when we harvest bamboo. So when harvesting, we have sound in mind. By touching the bamboo and knocking on the wall, we anticipate the sound. So embodiment already begins. We process the bamboo by heating, oiling, leaving them for a few years. And finally, we can process and fashion into a flute. It's a very long and slow process. I like to share a story of this piece of bamboo as a case in point. On April 1st, 2019, that's last year, around 7 p.m., I received a text message from my sister in Japan. She said, "Our parents' house got fire." I thought it was a joke, but within the next 10 minutes, I also received similar messages from my hometown friends. "Are your parents okay? How's your brother? What happened?" So I realized it was not a joke. I got worried about my mom because she just had a knee replacement surgery, so she couldn't walk at all. So next morning, I flew back to Japan from Hong Kong. Fortunately, everyone was safe, but my parents and my brother's houses next to each other got burned down. And that's where I stored most of my stuff, things that I accumulated during my 30 years of living in Japan, including my grand piano, my trumpet, photo albums, books, music, and things that I couldn't bring to Hong Kong. They were all gone. So I dug into a pile of ash trying to find something I could save. And that piece of bamboo was the only thing that I could save. I harvested it during the Bamboo Roots pilgrimage that I organized in 2007. It was such a giant piece of bamboo and I couldn't harvest it by myself. So my friends helped me. So together we dug it out. Our teacher thought we are not serious to have harvested such a giant piece of bamboo because that's not suitable for the shakuhachi. So we all remember this piece of bamboo. The piece was burned, so I applied dressing around it and then brought it to Hong Kong with me in my empty luggage. So on the way to Japan, my luggage was full of clothes for my brother and father who escaped from fire on barefoot. On the way back to Hong Kong, my luggage was empty, but this piece of bamboo. So this piece of bamboo symbolizes all that I had and lost in Japan. Turning this into flute has been a process of remembering, renewing, and recreating those memories and meanings. So the bamboo still has unpleasant smoky smell, but then I hope it will disappear as I blow. So now it looks like this. I made it in the flute. I'm very thankful that nobody got hurt at the fire. A new baby was born this year. My parents built a new house, which I haven't seen yet, but I'm hoping to visit them as soon as the pandemic subsides. By that time, this flute will represent our narratives of resilience, survival, and reunion. Okay. I'm still working on this route. As expected, you know, some notes are rather difficult to produce, but that's okay because I play this flute as a prayer. I don't intend to be musical, but try to make it as offering. That's how people in my tradition do. So I'm gonna play some notes on this, so hopefully you can hear. So hopefully you could hear a ma in music. No, so this is a continuous part from the previous talk. So thank you very much. I will pass over to the next speaker. Thank you.
Stop. And as a choreographer and dancer, I've been thinking a lot about how we might our values are just magnified. So as your choices affect a significantly larger. I want to focus today on choices. Whether a leader or not, everybody makes choices every day. Tuna or chicken, right or left turn, leave a job or a marriage. Some are inconsequential and some are very consequential. So I want you to take a moment. I want to just get in our bodies right now and imagine something you're wrestling with. So if, like, if you're hungry right now, maybe you're wrestling with hamburger or rice for lunch. Yeah. Or a larger might be whether to send your child to school during this pandemic moment, or stay at home, or quit a job. So just take a moment to pick something that you're wrestling with and think about one or two options right now. So option one would be to stay home, option two to go, whatever, okay? So take a moment, and I'd like you all to close your eyes and just imagine if you've already made the decision of option number one. So let's say you decided option number one. Scan your body. Is anything a flutter? And locate where that activity is taking place. Is your brain busy? Is your nervous system ramping up or down? Is your gut churning? Is your heart light or heavy? Stay with that for a moment. And now clear the slate. Bring in option number two. Think about that for a moment. locate where the activity is. Is your brain busy? Are you moving to more energy, less? Is your heart light or heavy? Now take a moment and just think about, was there any slight difference between those two? And you can open your eyes. So that was a little speed dating exercise. Usually I do that for a whole day, or I'll take a whole week to think about a certain option. But then I think when we use our body to make decisions, we also have to put it through a rigorous sieve. So I might take a second step on that. And if we had time, I'd lead you through it. But I'll just say, like, if I'm a leader and considering option number one or two of somebody I might hire, I might sit with option number one and feel like, oh, they give me a certain kind of comfort and softness. But if then I check it against my values, belief systems, I start to see, oh, they give me comfort because they're like me. They're the same as me. And so I feel safe with them. But is that what I really want? So then putting it through another sieve to say, oh, maybe I'll consider option number two, and maybe they make me feel more nervous, but maybe that energy and tension that I feel is a good thing. And so putting it through these body questions through many sieves is a part of the rigorous process of making really good choices for yourself. So I want to read an op-ed that I just recently wrote that's a little story of my own about making choices. So here's your little story. Facts matter flashes across screens constantly as an important contrast to the swirl of misinformation spewed daily. Just the facts, ma'am, as Joe Friday famously said in the Dragnet classic. I support this, facts are important, but my stomach has been feeling queasy lately. As a dance artist, I have spent a lifetime resisting an over-reliance on the facts and communicating the essentialness of the body's wisdom in making life choices. The overkill of facts matter is understandable, especially in the US, in which the president has been notoriously dismissive of science and facts. And as much as I believe in listening to the body, I was disturbed to hear the president say, I have a gut, and my gut tells me more sometimes than anybody else's brain can ever tell them. Hearing the president justify his decisions based on his gut prompted a moment of crisis for me. Could I really be this out of alignment with our data-driven culture and in cahoots with Donald Trump? No doubt, thanks to the president, intuition is getting a bad rap. But unlike the president's example, intuition only becomes useful when it has been cultivated through a rigorous and ongoing practice. My early research as a choreographer was conducted within a female-based dance world, which allowed for internal discoveries. I asked where love resides, in the heart or the brain. I studied communal bathing as a doorway to cultural differences, sweating in the hammams of Istanbul and jumping into ice pools of Helsinki. Frivolous, you may think, but by positing research as a journey into the unknown, the body became both a guide and a library containing volumes of stories that signaled right from wrong. Values were written into my fascia. Trust your gut, listen to your heart became important listening points. Neurosciences, of course, have confirmed that the brain continuously responds to the heart and gut. It was not until later in life when I came into a leadership position in a very large hierarchical male-dominated institution, I realized how foreign my approach to life had become. In my earlier world, I had been free to cackle and scream, just like the witches in medieval times. This place was as foreign as plunging into a hole of the ice. A leader was thought to be decisive, organized, and most of all, in control. Nobody inquired about my gut, and it didn't matter if a decision aligned with my heart. So leadership, like most other things, has been shaped by those who've been leading for a millennia. Rupturing this norm seems critical if people of color and women are to not only enter leadership, but thrive. So what if instead leadership was a circuitous journey and leaders consulted their bodies as a trusted guide? The bile gets caught in my throat as I realize how this proposition sounds a little like our present nightmare. Making ethical choices should be inherently a collaborative discussion between mind and body. Facts should be filtered through a sieve, one made up of embodied values. Rupturing the norm should mean a synthesis of two worlds rather than a seesaw to the other side. Thankfully, my stomach quiets down. Trump's facts are anything but. His gut is rooted in ego, the seat of his values, which is happily in control without checks and balances. His base loves him for this genuine, authenticity, a source really of his charisma. Trump sadly reminds us that listening to the body does not always mean that integrity is present. But I won't let him own my message. The facts say one thing, but my sagging jaw says something different. If I ask why, I get a lively conversation. And when the body has been attended to and is in consultation with the facts, we arrive at decisions that are integrated with our values. With every choice, the body knows before the brain knows. It senses when something is wrong and it intuits conflicts between body and mind, feelings and intellect, truth and lies. It absorbs experiences and it never lies. Facts matter and so does the gut. Next time an important decision looms, go through the facts and figures, then ask, will your heart be happy? Thank you. Turning it over to Bonnie. Your mic's not on.
Okay. So my name is Bonnie Weiss. I'm an internal family systems therapist. I'm based in California. So I just want to say a little bit about what internal family systems is. It's really, for me, it's a way of bringing spiritual knowledge, depth, and capacity into the therapeutic environment, which was always a struggle, you know, have spiritual depth and capacity and not proselytize in the office. So a quickie about me. Whoops, it's not going. I'm a teacher and a supervisor. I've done a lot of international teaching. Don't want to waste time with that. So the issue with internal family systems is that it works with parts. It sees us as human beings as being a system of parts. I'm going to go on to this. Okay. So that the idea of internal family systems is that we all have a group of little people inside of us. And those little people are like little silos. They talk in the corporate world about silos. So each little person has its own view of the world. It has its own history, its own beliefs, its own sense of the importance of its job. And the most important thing is that each of those little people inside of us has a positive intention for the system. I think we can all imagine that there are certain people inside of us, you know, like our hard worker and our professional and our good wife and good mother that we really like and support. And then we have little people that are angry or judgmental or withdrawn or are critical of ourselves and others that we don't really prefer to like so much. This thing doesn't go so fast. Okay. So the way the system is divided is that there are protectors. The protectors interact with the outside world. There are parts that manage our interactions with the world and they defend us from underlying pain. Examples are people pleaser, inner critic, intellectual, procrastinator. Those are the people in the outside world. And the parts that they defend and protect are called exiles because they are exiled out of our consciousness. So the exiles are the wounded child parts. They carry pain and negative beliefs that result from childhood situations. The issues with the exiles is they want to be heard and they want to be healed. So examples are shame, guilt, fear, feelings of being worthless. So it's just a quick picture. We'll talk about embodiment in a second, embodied creativity. So this is just a little picture we say, so that this is a woman who's a creative. She's got a documentary film that she's trying to make, and she's very excited about doing it. But she has this history where she showed herself as a child and she was humiliated. So that what happened is that she has these protector parts that try to keep her from getting started and doing her work. They procrastinate or distract. They keep her really busy because they're afraid of really being too full and too out in the world and being exposed. And she also has, I don't know if you can see, is that she's got an inner critic who's inside of her that says, what's the matter? You're lazy, you're distracting yourself, get busy. So the aspects of parts are that each part embodies a set of belief and experiences. Each part has a positive intention, and each part can often have a silo mentality. And then there's what we call the self. So the self is the true spiritual center of the internal system. It's who we truly are when we're not taken over by a part. The self can work to heal, and the self can lead the internal system. So in most therapies, the therapist is the kind of the smarty pants in the room, and you look to the therapist for help. In the internal family system, we work with people to get to know their parts, get some space from their parts, and to really use their internal self as the healer. So I'm just going to take you with really, really quickly, ask you to close your eyes, and just for a minute, I'm just going to talk about the aspects of what we call self, okay? So I'm going to just name the qualities, and I just want you to feel them in your body. Like, what does it feel for you to be caring? Where do you feel caring in your body? Is it your heart? Is it your arms? What about clarity? When you bring up clarity in your body, where is it? Is it in your mind? Is it in your heart? Is it in your belly? Somebody was talking about intuition before, clarity. What about calm? Where do you keep calm in your body? What happens when you bring it in? Do your shoulders go down? Does your breath deepen in your belly? Creativity. My hands start to twitch. They want to draw, they want to paint. When I think about creativity, my mind gets perky. Another quality of self is courage. What happens when you bring courage into your system? Do you expand your breath? Does your chest poke out? Do you feel strength in your arms? Connection. What's here when you think about connection? Is it your heart? Is it your arm? Is it your head? Curiosity. What happens when curiosity is here? Do you get curious with your eyes, with your ears, with your mouth? Do you get curious with your belly? Does your heart get curious? And then there's compassion. You know, what happens when we bring compassion into the room? So what we talk about in IFS is that we want the self to be sitting in the seat of consciousness. We want the self to be there, not one of the parts. But too often what happens is that some part blocks our creativity. Some part of us that is not our favorite part is sitting in that seat. So the idea in IFS is to, this is where the self is blocked by the parts. So creativity is blocked, that creative aspect is blocked by the parts. They're occluded. So you see those protector parts on the outside blocking that, and those little young, more fragile tender exile parts are kind of behind the curtain of consciousness. And of course, where we're heading is to unblock creativity, where the parts are unblended from the self, so that the self, who you really are, can take up much more space in your system and can have a relationship with all of those parts. So the goals for IFS work is to transform each part so that it can have its fall back into its healthy role, and to enable parts to trust the self to be the leader in the system, and to have parts cooperate with each other. You know, I could talk more, but maybe people want to just end, you know, have some interaction in the panel. I think that's what people were wanting. Very, very often parts can be polarized. You can often have an experience where you have one part, a part that wants to be successful and out in the world, and that can be polarized, you know, as in that example of another part who wants to be, you know, pulled in and safe. The man who developed this system, Richard Schwartz, was working with inpatients who, particularly in eating disorders unit, and people who cut and were suicidal. And he would always hear people say, I want to be skinny and you know, svelte and out there, you know, and then I want to be withdrawn. I want to be successful. I want to be protected. So it pushes us to know that when we have one part that feels, let's go away from this. When we have one part that feels really strong and out there in a way that takes over the system, to know that there's probably another part on the other side which holds the exact opposite. So we work in IFS to help people get some space and some separation from their parts and really let this self, this embodied self, come forward. The only last thing I want to say is that we work a lot with the body, and I've been thinking a lot and doing some writing about each of those different parts that we have having its own somatic profile, and beginning to help people tune in to, I would even ask each of the presenters as you came in today, like, what were those parts that were here? Was it excitement? Was it nervousness? Was it self-awareness, whatever? But if you just think of one part that was here when you brought yourself onto the call today, just think of one part and just ask, what is the somatic profile of that part? How do I embody it? You know, do I hold my breath? Do I tense my jaw? Do I feel tension in my back, my belly? Can I feel my feet? So as we get to know our parts, we can get to know the somatic profile. And as we get to know our parts, we can ask them to give us some space so that the real self will be able to come through and our creativity will be able to flow. And I think that's all I need to say.